If the low brass is playing an A exact and my violin is tuned perfectly, my A will vibrate without me doing anything. Like, the string vibrates. You can see it happen. So this, you know, when everything is perfectly in tune and the instruments are perfectly together, there's an extra vibration you're actually a part of. And that just makes the emotion that much stronger. It's totally incredible. Artist, the right brain, and then the engineer, the left brain. Right? This idea that you can build service discovery or a service mesh that will be reliable and that could, you know, if you deployed in Google Cloud and Azure and Amazon, and your Amazon instance goes down and you want to put up a backup, you know, in a different region or in a different cloud, and you just can. I mean, it's the technical, it is a challenging engineering problem.
By Sunday Pajamas. Jessica, first of all, I would like to thank you. I've been really waiting to have a discussion with you about the company you are trying to build next and the company you're working with right now. And apart from that, I would say your background as a professional violin and viola player and teacher. I would say personally, it's very fascinating. And I was very surprised to learn that that's where you, you know, got started with. And eventually, right now, you're working with HashiCorp, which is one of my very favorite companies. Just a personal note, I think they are the smartest company on the planet. That's what I think. But we'd also, you know, would like to learn from you. How has your experience been? And overall, I hope, you know, we both can have some fun together.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sounds great.
To get started with, right, would you like to talk about the startup you are working on right now? And then, you know, later on, we can maybe go back to where the idea came from.
So currently, I'm working on a startup called Unlighten. And really, the goal is to create communities that are specific for teachers. I was a public school teacher, and so much of my time was spent with my students in the classroom, which is where the work needs to happen. And at the end of the day, all of my coworkers and I were exhausted, and we would be with students after, and then we would go home after the school day. And then we have grading and lesson planning. And so no real opportunity to talk with each other about what was happening. So my goal is to help build communities inside of schools that are private to the school and available online, so that way that teachers have a sort of virtual staff lounge where they can have all these discussions that they just don't have time to have, but also to make that community accessible to other schools and other communities, so that way that teachers can work with teachers from other schools, administrators can work with administrators from other schools, and create learning communities in education that are available and accessible.
And could you also share, like, you know, your experience with being a teacher for, I think, the earlier part of your career?
I started teaching violin when I was 19, and it's how I put myself through college. So I taught probably 20 or 25 hours a week every day after my classes. I taught children to play violin, and it really made me realize that I love teaching, and I still love teaching. So when I graduated, I started teaching in a small school in Vermont. I taught band, I taught orchestra, I taught marching band, which was really very interesting because it's just not the thing that I do. But I did it. And then I moved to New York City to do my graduate school education and taught in a large, large public school there. And I taught orchestra and band, and music production and chorus and music history. I started the drumline program there. So really just a lot of fun to do and to teach. And I still, even though I don't teach now as my main career, I still teach Python to kids. I teach intro classes. I teach software testing classes and workshops from time to time. Teaching is a really big part of who I am and what I like to do.
And so when you say that, you know, you started teaching violin at the age of 19, so when did you start learning it? And how did you like first got introduced to the idea of learning it?
So I learned about the violin when I was 8 years old. Our school had a program. My parents didn't have any money for music lessons or anything. They knew I liked to sing, but that was kind of really it. And so our school said, oh, well, you can play the violin. And when you're nine, when you enter in the US, it's the fourth grade. And I really wanted to do it. Like, I didn't know why. I hadn't picked one up before. And I was so small as a nine-year-old that my grandparents had to get a special violin for me the first year because I was too small for all of the school violins.
Oh, like a small one.
Small one. So I started, it was funny because I brought the violin home. I got the special violin. I brought it home and I really wanted to play it badly. And, and the teacher had said, don't take it out. Don't use the bow. Don't do it. And my mother, a little bit of a rebel, she says, well, why not? And so, I did take it out and I did start to play with it. My parents didn't have money for private lessons at all. So I studied at school and played in school orchestra, but then every day at home I practiced. I loved practicing. I was really not good in the beginning. No child really, starts out sounding very good. And so my mother used to make me practice outside, like quite a lot, because she was just like, no, this is, you go out. But I loved it. And I mean, I haven't stopped loving it since.
How did you understand that, I can actually start teaching violin? Because that's pretty entrepreneurial of you at a very young age. Pick up a job. You could do so many other things to make money,
My violin teacher in college, the first private lesson teacher that I had, was my teacher my first year of college. And I went to a school called Plattsburgh State, and that was in Plattsburgh, New York, very small state college. They didn't at that time have a music major program, but I still took all of the extra music classes. And so one of these classes was my violin lessons. And she saw that I liked teaching in general. So when she would get calls for very beginner students, she would give those students to me. And she actually taught me about how to teach and the basics that I needed to teach them. And because I was really, when I was really having to rethink my own basics because I spent my whole life without private lessons and private instruction. So I was thinking about doing my own. And I was also thinking about, okay, and how do I explain this to a six-year-old? And so both of those things kind of happened at the same time. And teaching violin at the time paid a lot better than a job in a grocery store or in a restaurant. I did have those types of jobs too. I did work in a restaurant as a waitress, but my violin teaching paid a lot more. So whenever I was able to do that, I chose that first.
So you say you are a self-taught violin. You learned it on your own. And I started to learn violin during the pandemic using this app called Trala. I'm not sure if you're aware about it. It's a Chicago-based company. And it's a very guided way of, learning the violin. And I still struggle with it. So when a nine-year-old gets access to a violin and starts practicing, on her own, how do you think you kind of figured out your way around it since there were no private classes for it?
Yeah. So we had a school orchestra. And so every week I would go to the orchestra class and the teacher would give all of us a group lesson and teach us you know, she would give little tips and tricks. So I think that helped because I really paid attention. I was very interested. So, you know, I tried very hard to do everything the way that she said, which I think helped me to just get her feedback. And then, you know, I think part of it, a lot of playing any musical instrument is focusing on the sound that you're getting. And technique helps us get to the outcome, which is sound. So the better your technique is, the more relaxed you are, the better your, you know, your hand frame for your left hand, the better your bow hand for your right hand. Of course, the more easily that tone and sound comes. And as a young child, I wanted to make music. So getting to the outcome was probably, I was just so focused on that. Everything else that I did, like if it didn't sound quite right, I was like, okay, why doesn't it sound right? What can I fix? And then the older I got, you know, I had classmates who were older. I had classmates who did have private lessons. And so we would play together during orchestra. They would play, I would watch them. So I think, you know, it was just taking in everything that I could around me and you know, talking with people, listening to people who did play, who were in school with me, watching how they played, watching violinists sometimes on television, if they're, you know, my parents would say, oh, there's a violinist on television, you have to come watch this. And so I think all of those things, but mostly wanting to make music that I liked to play, you know, playing songs that I knew that I liked, really helped me to focus on the joy of it and the outcome of it. And I adjusted a lot of my technique to that. Did I do it all correctly? Absolutely not. you know, I spent a lot of time in college redoing a lot of technique or just learning it the first time how to properly do something. And I'm still, I don't regret that time that I didn't really learn things exactly properly, because what I did learn was to love the instrument and to be really persistent about the outcome, getting the outcome that I want.
Yeah. And you know, you also, I think, play with orchestras.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you start teaching the violin, and so you're doing that. So how does the orchestra thing come along?
Well, so, you know, when you're in college as a music student, you are required to play chamber music and orchestral music. So you're required to play solos. So you have to do all of these things, which I'd never done, and except for in school. But at the college level, it's definitely different. So that's when I really started to understand how powerful a full orchestra is, how beautiful it sounds to sit inside of a sound. I mean, if you imagine your favorite symphony or your favorite, you know, band or anything, and you imagine that you hear it on great speakers, then imagine being in the speakers, the vibration of the drums, the brass sitting all, I mean, it's a whole different experience. So once I had that experience of sitting inside of a full orchestra, I was totally hooked on doing this. And so even though I didn't have to play in orchestras anymore after I graduated, I actually went back to the college orchestra director and said, hey, can I keep playing? And he said, you can, but you have to play viola. And I was like, but I don't have a viola. I don't really know how to play viola, and I don't know how to read alto clef. I was like, I don't know how this is supposed to work. And he says to me, well, we have a viola, and it's basically like the violin. So the clef you'll figure out. And I was just like, are we serious right now? And he was very serious. And that's actually, you know, so I ended up after college, the first thing I did was pick up viola back in the same orchestra and just kind of learned viola at that point. But it was my way to keep playing as an adult. It was to be in orchestras, and to and to really experience not only the beauty of just the sound, but also the community of other people who are playing, who want to be playing. So it's a really great, it's just a great experience that I've always loved.
Could you share, you know, a little bit as to how these orchestras are organized or like built?
Sure. So there's lots of different kinds of orchestras, right? We all know the big orchestras, the Berlin Philharmonic, the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, the London Symphony. Like, we know the big orchestras. And those orchestras are really, they're highly competitive with players from the top schools and who've been playing with private lessons since they were 3 years old. These orchestras are a full-time job. So they hire, you know, when you audition for that orchestra, it's a very serious audition. They hire people as if it's like, they're like the HashiCorp of orchestras or the Amazon or the Google of orchestras. They are hiring full-time musicians. Those musicians practice 5 or 6 hours a day. They're in rehearsals every day. They have, you know, hundreds of rehearsals and many concerts and concert appearances a year. So that's how those orchestras operate. Those are like the top professional orchestras. Then you have, in many places, regional orchestras. So my county in New York, the I live in Orange County, and there's Dutchess County also. And so there are three orchestras here that I play with. And they're also professional in that they pay money, but they're more like a part-time job because they pay you for the rehearsals and for the concert. So that's kind of how it's organized. And then what that means, though, is that you actually have a lot less rehearsals. So for every concert that I do, I probably play two concerts a month. I have an orchestra week where it's three rehearsals and then the concert. And so it's quite intense because I get the music, I have to practice, work out all the difficult parts. Then you go to the orchestra with everybody else who's there, and it's a lot like coworkers, but instead of talking, you know, I have my section and it's the six other violinists who play the same part. We play the same part together. And then we have the viola section and they play a different part. And then we have all the brass instruments. So all of these different parts playing together, but we have to listen. And the conductor has their vision that they shape. You know, they say, oh, well, I want to play Beethoven this way with power and a lot of lyricism. So that means that you guys have to do a longer bow here and play this part at the frog. And they have all kinds of instructions to help us understand and execute their vision for the music, right? Which is a big part of the work of the rehearsals, is understanding the conductor's vision and then using my technical skill, all of us using our technical skill, to make his vision or her vision a reality.
You know, I have always had this question. First of all, could you share a little bit about the kind of music orchestras plays? I would say I listen to this genre of music a lot, which is, I think it's pronounced Baroque. Baroque?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. Baroque.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and according to Spotify, it's my number one genre since the last 2-3 years now. And I did not know this, but Baroque is like a time period when a lot of things happen and not just music.
Yes.
Right? Like, you know, there is Baroque architecture, there is Baroque fashion, there is Baroque music. So I've always been fascinated about the genre, like wanting to know more about the genre from an orchestra or a musician's perspective who are in it, which I think we can discuss. And also, do these orchestras, you know, compose original music as well when they are performing in front of an audience?
Yeah, that's a good question. We'll start with a Baroque question. So as you've figured out, Baroque is a stylistic period in orchestral music. So, I mean, I would say that that Bach is probably the most prolific Baroque composer we know, Vivaldi. So things like the Four Seasons, for any violinist, Bach sonatas and partitas, the unaccompanied sonatas and partitas. Anybody who loves organ music has probably heard Bach organ music. So the thing about the Baroque, whether it's Baroque architecture or art or orchestral music or solo music, is you will probably notice detail. It never, never, never stops. As when I'm playing Baroque music, it's just like it's constant. I'm constantly moving, playing the Vivaldi Four Seasons, whether it's the solo part or with the orchestra. You're just going and going and going. And every instrument is always moving, and there's the counterpoint. So the instruments move both with and against each other harmonically to create tension, but then bring it back together for closure, right? So, and I think that's something that you kind of see in Baroque art and architecture too. It's very ornate, it's very detailed, it's very,
Pretty intricate.
yes. And, so I think that's, that's something when you're playing Baroque music in particular, it's actually, it can be quite hard because it's exhausting just because you never stop, you never have a rest. But it's also really, studying Bach. I've studied the same Bach partita and really invested time in it for probably almost 20 years now. Just trying to pick up details and learn different ways of phrasing and how to make a single line have multiple, the feel of multiple voices, of which for the solo works is you that's the point, but it's also really hard. And I think with Baroque orchestras, it's listening, knowing, like, sure, I play all the time. When am I important and when am I not important? When is something else important? When is another instrument important in order to make the whole picture come alive? So from that perspective, I think that that's kind of it's an interesting thing about playing Baroque music and just understanding the way that harmony and melody and really the experience of the Baroque comes through in an orchestral setting. In terms of orchestras kind of recording and playing, there are different kinds of orchestras. Like I said, there's like the professional, the big orchestras, they all, of course, they go in studios, they do live recordings, they have all the resources to do this. One of the orchestras I play with in New York, the Park Avenue Chamber Symphony, they do recordings of their work. And I'm actually I played with them on and off since 2009. So I there are recordings that I've done with them that are on Spotify. And it's fun but also terrifying. Just because you're like, oh God, like the mistake, right? Like you don't want to make your mistake in that moment, And then some of the regional orchestras, one of them I have a recording session coming up with in March. And so, so there's these, sometimes it's recording in a studio, sometimes it's hiring the sound crew to come and set up in a particular location. It really depends on what they're trying to do, like the purpose of the recording. And so, but yeah, it's something that we do. And it's definitely nerve-wracking, but not as bad as not as nervous for me as like a solo recording.
So you mentioned Bach, but I have been seeking out other composers, I would say, the kinds of the like for example Robert Schumann, Claude Debussy, Richard Wagner. I'm just a listener. I don't understand the technicality of it, but I would say they, for me personally, they demand your attention, and once you kind of give it to them, they take you with them, and they kind of just play with it in a very, playful way. And they'll make you sad, and they'll make you excited, and they'll make you happy. And if you're paying attention, right, you kind of understand that, you know, you have surrendered and that you cannot do anything about it.
And I think that that's the best part, though, of like, I mean, without listeners, what is an orchestra, first of all? You know, so I always, whenever somebody says, oh, I'm just a listener, it's like, you're the reason the orchestra exists. The listener is the reason that a musician exists. Without listeners, a musician is very lonely at home playing music. And that's nice. And the joy of being in an orchestra is hearing the audience gasp or hearing just total silence, even from small children, because they're so taken in, which is, it's really strange, especially in today's world, you know, because an orchestra is one of the few places that people say, put away your phone. So it's like, okay, that's an interesting fact that this is something that happens and that people still do it and choose to do it. That's the reason. The composers you mentioned are a lot of romantic composers, which makes a lot of sense when you talk about the emotional journey, because that's sort of that's kind of considered one of the key aspects of romantic music, is the change in emotions, yes, and the stretching of sound and time and stopping, resting. The violins finally get a break, right? It's like time for the woodwinds to play. We're very happy about this. but yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all that you have this experience with it. And yeah, I mean, it makes actually romantic composers some of my favorite.
It's quite religious. Yeah. The experience is very religious, I would say.
Yeah, there's definitely, one can go to a higher plane in that way.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, when you mentioned that when you're playing in an orchestra, the experience is that you are inside of the speaker, right? So how was, could you describe that emotion? Because that's, our audience is in front, right? But when you're inside of it, how would that be like?
I mean, the first time I really, really experienced it was when I was playing Holst's Planets in my college orchestra. And I was sitting in the viola section. And it's this once, Jupiter is my favorite movement from the Planets. It's my favorite movement. I love this so much. I could be paid to play this all the time and never be sad. I cry every time I play it. Like, I always have as a player. And as a viola, you sit by the timpani and by the low brass. So there's really a ton of actual physical vibration. And so I'm sitting in the middle of Jupiter, in the middle of Jupiter. Like, it's, there's this subsection that's a hymn. Do do boop boo do 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 do. And it's really slow and it builds up from one line, layer and layer. And as it's building, I'm actually feeling the vibration of the low brass and the vibration of, and so it's, you know, as a listener, you hear the vibration. If you had speakers, you would see the speakers moving. But as a player, I'm feeling it in my chest, because when things are perfectly in tune, I mean, like if the low brass is playing an A exact and my violin is tuned perfectly, my A will vibrate without me doing anything. Like, the string vibrates. You can see it happen. So this, you know, when everything is perfectly in tune and the instruments are perfectly together, there's an extra vibration you're actually a part of. And that just makes the emotion that much stronger. It's totally incredible.
You know, I cannot even, I would say, imagine how much coordinated practice it would require for, let's say, an orchestra of 20, 30, 50 people to be in sync.
So it's really funny, like the regional orchestras that I play in, we're very skilled players and we're not playing every single day as our job. So we have to really go home. We have to take the conductor's thoughts. We have to know our conductor well and know what they'll be looking for. I know of my conductors, I know that I have one conductor that likes every single thing to be very, very short in the bow. I have another conductor who likes everything to have a ton of emotion and vibrato. So knowing the conductor and what they tend to like is helpful in preparation before the rehearsal. And then for the larger orchestras, you know, for the top orchestras, they are really hiring and looking for musicians that can do this and figure this out, and also for a very specific sound. You can tell when you're listening to Berlin versus Cleveland versus New York versus Philadelphia, because the conductor is so strong in their vision, and the musicians that they choose in the audition are musicians that fit not just the technical skill, but the vision and the sound. What kind of a sound do they want to create? So this is something that it goes beyond the coordination of the rehearsals. The big orchestras, they hire the very, very best players. Technically, they could get whoever they wanted. And they hire those players who already have the sound that they want, the sound quality. So, you know, of course, when you can do that, it's much easier then you're focusing on the finer points. You're not focusing on coordination or technique. You're focusing on...
It's already taken care of, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the big orchestras have an advantage for sure. And I love, you know, playing in the regional orchestras, we are still, you know, we're working toward those goals always and coming prepared. You know, we come as prepared as we can. You know, I spend a couple hours a day practicing still. You know, when I'm not playing, I still spend time practicing and working out the orchestral music so that I go ready to make changes, to blend, to take the conductor's vision and try to bring that to life.
Fascinating.
It's a whole world.
Yeah, it's really fast. Like, I have only watched, but just watching does not tell you the details of it. This is
yeah.
Yeah, this is the first time I would say I'm listening to all of this. I don't think I'm gonna sleep tonight.
It's so nice. There's a great podcast I can recommend. So I study for the past year and again this year, I've studied with Nathan Cole, who's one of the concertmasters of the LA Philharmonic. And he and his wife, Akiko, have a podcast called Stand Partners for Life. And they're both violinists. They've both played with lots of orchestras. So if you're anybody who's really interested in hearing like the details of any kind of like orchestral playing, I highly recommend it. I listened to it just for the first time in the past year. And so interesting. If you want to know like the dirt on orchestras and what it's like, it's highly fascinating.
It is a subtle secrets of the harmony. I would say, you know, it's so wonderful that, you know, this is a part of your life. It's so cool, man.
It informs so much of how I think about things, and I think it's been a real constant in my life and in my personality and just what I care about, and having almost, you know, having I almost lost it back in 2020. So really realizing how much I cared about it just reinvigorated my passion toward it.
This is just one part of your life, which is already very fascinating. Could you share? So you do all of this. You graduate from college. You want to do orchestra again for the love of it. So how did you, I don't know, think about it, figure out, or got interested in engineering?
Yeah. So
this
I'm
is,
a little.
This is like north and south in my world.
I think it's that way in a lot of people's worlds, right? Like, yes. People think, oh, like the artist, the right brain, and then the engineer, the left brain, right? And for me, it was not. It actually made like a lot more sense to me. People have always asked me that question, but really, when I was a little girl, my dad got our first computer. I mean, we didn't, like, he put it on a credit card. We didn't have money for like groceries or whatever. And he comes home with a computer, and my mom was just livid. She was so mad. I mean, like, if you imagine like a comedy show where the dad comes home and the mom's like, nah, 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 like this is the situation. And, you know, but he sets up the computer and then he gets a book on a PC logo, which is just using like programming the turtle. And I was programming, I spent hours like just making screensavers and figuring out how to use the turtle and write these programs. And they were like hundreds of lines. And my dad was, he would let me like stay up late when my mom was working. He'd be like, everybody go to bed. And I'd be like, but dad, and work. He's like, okay. And then he'd actually like watch the door. And when my mom got home, he'd be like, she's here, save, run. So like when I was really little, when I was like 10, 11 years old, this is what I'm doing. And then, you know, in high school, I actually was not a very good math student. I struggled to understand math. And my math teacher said, he actually told me that I was stupid. And I really believed it for a long time. So I kind of didn't do computers for a while. But then fast forward, it's 2007. My dad has discovered Linux and is so excited about it. And I have to teach a music production class. I don't have computers to teach it on. So I'm teaching in a New York City school. They're like, you're teaching music production. I'm like, okay, you have 25 kids. Cool. You have 10 laptops. Huh? And we're not buying you software. What? So I have to do this job and I don't have the materials to do the job. And at the very same time, my dad has been telling me on the side about open source and Linux and all these things. So I ended up spending the summer because this was all kind of new to me at that point. I ended up spending the summer making a USB stick with all the software that the kids could run on any computer in the school. So as long as they recorded and did things that they needed to in the recording lab, I could send them to the library with a USB stick, right? So I kind of got back into it because I had to. And because I wanted to do things like have a website for the class, which in 2007, in public schools, nobody was doing that. I mean, now we can't even imagine without it, but that was so new to be able to have material, you know, the kids, oh, I missed class. Okay. You know, the lecture from yesterday, just go on your phone and find it. They're what? I'm like, yeah, you know, so I got really into it as a part of teaching. And then I needed to do dissertation research and, you know, in 2012 and needed not to be teaching because I was actually working on my doctoral degree. But I still needed money to eat and pay rent. And so my boyfriend at the time said, oh, have you ever, you know, have you thought about testing, software testing? And I was just like, dude, what's that? And he's like, you know, you break software. And I was like, because he was a developer. And so, you know, he's like, yeah, you just break software. I'm like, wait, they pay you for this? Because that's me. I'm the person who always finds the weird thing. He's like, yeah, and you'll be perfect. Like, you're so anal retentive. And I was just, you know, like that's an insult, but also you're not wrong. Right. He was right. My first day, first 4 hours, I'd never done it. I had no instructions. They're just like, here's a wireframe, write down the problems in the spreadsheet. I was like, okay. And I found 76 bugs in 4 hours. And it was just, I was hooked on the exploring things and how things worked. And to me, it felt the connection was almost immediate. When you go in a practice room with the violin and a Mozart concerto, you have a thing that somebody has written and you spend hours looking at every measure, trying to work out how to play it, how to phrase it. In software testing, you have a software product that somebody has built and you lock yourself in a quiet place and you have a test plan and you spend a hypothesis and you spend hours trying to figure out, okay, what would it look like if? What would this look like if? What are the risks? You know, so you start to ask these questions. So to me, it actually felt very, very natural.
Natural, yeah.
To do this. And then teaching myself Python and Ruby so I could do test automation also felt natural because music is a symbol system of language. computer programming is a symbol system and a language. So if you are abstract enough, the relationships are really, really close. And it never occurred to me that it was actually far away until people kept asking.
you got started in software testing. So what happened in the middle? How did you end up in HashiCorp in the end of it?
I was in testing for a long time. I spent the first 4 years being either the lead tester or the only tester and writing automation at smaller and mid-sized companies. So I worked at Rent the Runway for a little while. I worked at Bitly, doing front-end test automation with Python and Selenium, or Ruby and Selenium, Capybara, those kind of technologies. And then I moved over to Salesforce, and I had the opportunity there to go from being an individual contributor to a director role and building a team. So, management and teaching are just quite similar in my mind, because the role of a manager isn't do the thing. It's helping somebody grow to the best of their ability. And so I really loved, And so I really loved having and growing a team and helping every team member become the best at what it was that they wanted to do with their career. So to me, teaching and management were the perfect alignment. And I spent roughly 4 years at Salesforce, and over two as a director. And I had a large team. Well, large for me, it was the biggest team I've had. I had 30 people on my team. Then they had a reorg, and we had a lot of things shift around during the pandemic, which I think a lot of people experienced. And at that point, I thought to myself, the problems that I like to solve, the things I like to think about, are much more strategic. I really loved management. I loved understanding the business aspect of a product. I felt that understanding the business needs and the product needs really informed how I thought about risk, quality, releasing a product. And I also noticed, the past 2.5 years in the job, in the landscape, has been all over the map, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. Unfortunately, I noticed, it's unpredictable at best. And what I noticed was that there were not as many quality roles, but there were a lot of engineering management roles available. And I thought to myself, well, engineering management with a quality mindset is actually a really good idea. So I have the skills I need to be an engineering manager. If I can do a director of quality, I can also be an engineering manager. There are things I need to learn that I don't yet know. But one of my goals was to learn, to start learning those things. So I did a business degree. I started an EMBA and actually ended up finishing that last May. I got an engineering manager role at Influx Data and was there working on one of their open source products. So that was really great. And then I saw this, last year I saw this role at HashiCorp, and I've loved Hashi too. I've known about them and was working with them at my last company, working with the Terraform, deploying with Terraform. And I was just like, this is amazing. Imagine what you could do, smart solutions to hard problems. And so it made me want to work there. And then, a lot of companies talk about having a humble attitude and a learning attitude, but then you get into the company and it's not really that way. And what I will say is that Hashi actually means it when they say it. Our humility is probably our core value.
Yeah.
Humility and integrity, the things that matter most to me as a human being, the things that make it easy for me to be a good manager and to help people grow. So I was so excited to start there, and now I'm working on the console core product which is it is complex. It is the hardest technical learning I've had to do in my career. And I get to build out a lot of the internal engineering training because of my background in education. This is something that I get to do, which is just I can't tell you how much I'm enjoying the learning, enjoying having these brilliant teammates. I mean, the team that I manage is just filled with brilliant people who are happy to explain things to me in very simple ways and then help me turn that into a learning module. So as we bring new people in, they can then experience and learn in a way that helps them be successful and helps us all be more successful. So it's really it's incredible. It's such a great job. I wake up happy to go to work every single day. It's just awesome.
You know what I'm noticing? You take on a project where it may be an education project or the orchestra project or the testing project, and it seems to me, as an outsider, right, that everything you kind of learned in the last project kind of helps you in the next one. So maybe you are lucky that way, that you are presented with the opportunity, and you're also smart that you're able to explain the skills you have to the next person who is trying to work with you. And if you lack the skills, you somehow figure out how to get those skills as well. Like when you mentioned that in the council team, you are actually building the education material, which again comes down to the education career you have had for so long. And when you mentioned that, programming is very similar because even music notation is a coding system, if you think about it that way. So I see that, you're making all these connections, or like drawing commonalities in all these different things that you're doing. Do you feel it kind of comes natural to you, or do you actually sit down and think about these things? What do you think?
I think that it's kind of how my brain works. Like it does come naturally in that the thought just like pops in. Like, oh, huh, that's interesting. That's just like this. And then I'm like, really though? So the thoughts pop in, but then I do spend time to think about what is that, like, where did that thought come from? And what does it mean? And then asking questions. So like the first time I really was talking, I was talking with a coworker named August back at Rent the Runway. He was a product manager there. And we were talking, and he was the first person who told me about generative grammar and Noam Chomsky, which is like actually a huge foundation for comp sci. And I was blown away because what I was talking to him about was linguistics and as they applied to educational assessment, because I was finishing my doctorate at that time. And so it just blew my mind. And so it's like part of it is having the question and the thought. And then I've always taken those questions from the time I was 19 or 20 and written them down and then gone to, we've had Google since I was that age. Thank God, right? Like, so thank God I've had like the internet, because all of this is so much easier to go to research, to look for articles or blogs or videos, and then just say, I'm not the there's no way I can be the only person who's had this thought. But maybe I'm new to this thought in this way, but let me start pulling pieces. Let me see what other people have thought. So the question itself just pops in and visits, but writing it down and investigating it, and then if it turns out to be useful or helpful, writing about it, sharing it, doing something with the information, I think is the work part of it. Because I don't have an I am not Google. I am not ChatGPT. I only know what I know. And so a thought pops in, I have to find that backing information to see if it's see what it means. And if it is useful, or if it's just kind of like a weird idea that doesn't have any traction.
What do you think it is? I mean, it is one thing to, let's say, be curious and get the skills. It is another skill to understand these connections. It is a third thing to actually get the opportunity to actually, implement those insights that you're getting. So, how do you see your journey so far?
I think that part of it is people, there's a saying, and I don't know who's responsible for it. It isn't me, but luck is when preparation meets opportunity. Right? And so I do have an attitude in my life where the things that I focus on are things that I'm deeply interested in doing. And that's the first thing. I'm deeply passionate and I know what I'm passionate about. And so I put my energy where my passion is. That's, I think, the first thing that makes the journey easy, even when it's hard. Because it's like, okay, I can keep going because I'm passionate, even though I'm frustrated. I think the second thing is thinking about my own experience in the context of the world that I want to be a part of. I want to be a part of a world where we are good human beings to each other. I want to be a part of a world where I'm helping other people to live happy, fulfilling lives, whatever that looks like. And in my sphere of influence, it's mostly work and orchestra and the people I care about, my family. So in the ways that I can use my skills to impact the world around me and make it reflect more of what I want it to look like, that's helpful. And then, something that I do, and people, I think it depends on the context of a person's personality, of a person's workplaces, culture, opportunities, right? There's a lot of factors. And in the ways that I can, I look for opportunity. So there was no at work, at Hashi, people are like, we want to strengthen onboarding for engineers. And it wasn't, I wasn't like hired to do that in the console team. I was like, oh, well, we could do this and this and this because we have these systems and we can put it together this way. Like, oh, I have an idea. Let me present the idea because I have these skills, because I have this knowledge, and because I think I can put it together. So I think that that's a pretty, I think that's something that I don't know that my the things that I do are unique to me. I think maybe the way that I approach them is kind of like it's natural to me. So it's like, okay. But I do think that people can reflect on who they are and what they want to see in the world around them and how they're able to help to use whatever skills they have to help make that in a way. And then looking for the places where their skills and their passion could be useful, even if somebody isn't saying to them, oh, hey, you. Sometimes looking and saying, oh, that's me. I can, this is me. I can do that. I can go and make this amazing, right? So noticing when your skills are the right fit or when you think they are, and having like the kind of courage to stick your neck out and then maybe be told no, or maybe even be told no a few times in a few different ways.
Yeah,
So,
it's very fascinating if you ask me.
I deeply love what I do. I find a deep, deep amount of joy.
It's very visible, And you mentioned Terraform, right? Like you used to work with a bunch of guys who were using Terraform, trying to coordinate and all. Yeah, I would say that's also how I got introduced to HashiCorp to begin with. Did not know the name HashiCorp for a very long time.
Right.
And a bunch of my friends are like hardcore cloud engineers since the last 6, 7 years. And they keep on talking about the projects that the client is trying to upgrade the infrastructure, migrate the infrastructure, and trying to, as they call it, redo the whole thing on Terraform again. Like they built it, but they want to, keep up with the industry. And turns out Terraform is the industry, that's the default setting, right? And in that way, HashiCorp has really been able to define or maybe lead where things are going in the cloud native space. So could you share, first of all, how did you make sense of it, and like where HashiCorp is taking the world in some sense, and where is HashiCorp taking the world from what you can share maybe?
I mean, I can talk about sort of my experiences. And since I'm on the console team, we interact with the Terraform team, but we but it's definitely a separate, it's really a separate product system. In terms of Terraform though, I mean, what, and in terms of all of Hashi's products, I think that the focus that you can see, that anybody can see, is that we are about a open source, like really having access. Like if you want to learn it, you can go learn it. If you want to try it out, you can get the binary and try it out. So it's like everything's open, which I think provides so many opportunities for learning. I've worked on products for the past 6 or 7 years. Everything I've worked on almost has been open source. Because I just really, I understand that as a business model, there needs to be closed aspects. There needs to be ways to sell and have enterprise grade products, and those require a lot more support and work, right? So in different ways. So I understand that, but for to start with open source is just really exciting. And then I think the other thing that I really am fascinated by, and it's also a huge technical challenge, is that Hashi is focused on how do we open up to people wherever they are? Whether you want to deploy, do you want to deploy multi-cloud? Do you want to do multi-cloud and your bare metal server and HashiCorp, HashiCloud? Like, however you want to do it, Hashi wants to be there to do it with you, right? Like, and I think that the thing that's super smart about Terraform, when I first started using Terraform, I was blown away by the fact that you could just connect. There are so many connectors. There's so many
Yeah,
ways.
to
Like
everything.
you can,
Yeah.
yeah, and it's all in code, right?
Yeah,
So
it's
it
all,
meets
yeah.
engineers where we are, which is, hey, we're in GitHub, right? Or we're in some kind of version management system, and we're in Circle. So instead of having our all of our operate or all our DevOps and setup be in some different place that somebody has to memorize or run this shell script and hope that you remember to install all the right components, or oh, we upgraded this version of that, and now if you didn't get the memo,
Yeah.
like yours stops compiling. And Terraform kind of just solves all that because it is infrastructure as code, so the infrastructure becomes a part of ev it operates like everything else instead of being its own kind of separate entity. And I think that to me that was so it's so smart. I mean, it's like mind-bogglingly smart. It's like genius, right?
Yeah, like state management. They maintain it at any cost, no matter what you do.
Yeah,
Magic is the word for it.
it feels like magic. And it's actually technically, when I look at console, which is which is the I manage one of the console teams, and I manage the core team, and we're really responsible for the functionality of the core binary. This idea that you can build service discovery or a service mesh that will be reliable, and that could, if you deployed in Google Cloud and Azure and Amazon, and your Amazon instance goes down and you want to put up a backup, in a different region or in a different cloud, and you just can. I mean, it's the technical, it is a challenging engineering problem, right? It is. And it's one of the most complicated products I've worked on, but what it offers people, what it offers users, is this ability to really have reliability of their services and scalability of their services across this, this really the service mesh idea. So again, learning about the internals of this is just mind blowing. Like the things that have been implemented to make this possible. It is a massive learning journey for me, coming from writing Selenium tests and then doing some unit testing to, okay, service mesh, welcome. Like it's a whole, but what but the problems we're solving are really truly fascinating, and I think are going to, I think it is leading because it is applicable. You know, we really aim to be agnostic.
Yeah.
All of Hashi's products aim to be agnostic, meet you where you are. And so I think that's the key strength that Hashi has as a company.
So you take all these learnings and you're trying to kind of put it in the teaching community business you're trying to build.
In a different way, yes.
Different way, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, for me, part of being in any situation is like, okay, what can I learn from this in general? And what I'm learning as a part of, you know, having been in small startups, having seen how software is built, having seen what does product market fit mean, right? So this is the struggle I have right now, is that education is, you know, it's in the United States at least, and I believe to a lesser extent in the UK, but I think around the world in general, because of the pandemic, education has experienced a massive shakeup. We know students have learning loss, and nobody's really sure what to do about it.
Millions of kids, actually, yeah. They lost a year or two. Yeah.
Right. And parents, you know, they've done the best they can because they're trying to take care of their kids and their families, and maybe their parents or other, you know, they've experienced illness. And then you're looking at education systems where basically kids are just are going back into school. And now teachers are trying to make up for years of learning loss, years of social loss, right? Because kids don't really socialize on Zoom meetings the way that they would in a classroom. And so there's all this social loss. So there's all these difficulties that occur to me, and it makes it hard to, start a business and sell a product around this. So actually I'm really moving, you know, I always had an open community model as the model, and now I was trying to be like very global about it, but I'm actually pulling back, and I'm going to work with the local schools where I can go in, talk with them, and really see, meet teachers where they are and meet administrators where they are, and really get beta work done. But all of this I wouldn't know how to do if I hadn't worked in tech businesses.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean, I build my WordPress site myself, you know, I do all that stuff. So that's just some tech skills put in, you know, but yeah, all that stuff doesn't happen. I wouldn't be able to imagine how to do all these things without all the experiences that I've had.
You know, before I came in, before I decided to, you know, let's say have a coffee and sit down, I was thinking that you are going to share some insight which is going to be so simple because you figure it out. And because I was coming from the world where, you know, oh, violin, oh, engineering, oh, different modes, right? But when you shared that, you know, music is basically coding in a different language. And I was like, that's what I was looking for, you know?
Yeah, it really is, right? And it's like,
totally makes sense.
Which you can see, and I mean, I know tons of musicians. Like, so I work with a guy who's now at Google, who had a doctorate in discrete mathematics and was a harpsichord player. I worked with another guy who had his doctorate in music theory and composition, who was a lead engineer, who was one of the lead engineers that I worked with at the company. So, yeah, I mean, it's really common, but I think seeing the relationship, sometimes people are like music and math, and it's like, no. It's actually not the math part, right? Because I am a terrible math student. I struggled with math. I was a C student at best, but it's an abstract symbol system, and you use it to make things. That's it. Like, I'm just like, oh yeah, that makes sense to me. And the way you work with it, you break it apart, right? Like when you're testing code or you're testing a site, you're not just like, oh no, the whole website. You're like, oh, let me look at this field. And when you're looking at unit tests, you're looking at, okay, what are the individual tests that are happening? What's the coverage look like? When you're looking at a piece of music, you're like, oh my God, I have to play this whole concerto. You're like, what is this note?
Yeah.
You know, and then you go to the parts that are hard. So yeah, to me, it's just like, well, this is what I've been doing my whole life, just with a violin in my hand.
Do you feel? So, I have done courses, online courses on this subject called the science of learning, like learning how to learn, you know? Do you feel like you are like the perfect teacher for something like that? No?
I've given talks about it. It's I spent a
You
lot of
have?
time studying that.
Yeah, I was
I
just
gave a talk.
guessing.
I mean, I have a lot of experience there because of A, being a teacher and studying learning, metacognition, and these aspects of, okay, well, how do you learn? Well, how does anybody learn, right? And when they studied, they actually were studying geniuses back in the 70s. And then they found accidentally when they were studying small children that small children and people who are considered expert geniuses do the same process in learning. And so I studied like a lot around that because it's actually the process that when I successfully learn something, it's also the thing that I'm doing. And so, you know, I actually find it quite interesting. And it's something that people, if you don't know about it, then, you know, it doesn't occur to you. But once you do know about it, it's so simple and powerful. You're like, oh, you can apply it anywhere. It's a very easy system. It's not like you need to know a lot. You just need to know what metacognition is and then apply it. And it's like this beautiful thing. But yeah, I can send a link to that talk if you want, because I gave it to a software testing conference. And what I did to show it was I actually gave the audience, somebody in the audience, a chance to pick a part of Mozart's fourth concerto on the violin that I'd never played before. And they picked two lines and I learned it in front of them.
Wow.
I was like, okay, so I don't know this, but this is the process I'm going to use to learn it. And doing it with the violin means that they can hear me learning.
I want to watch it because I'm trying. I think I showed you last time. I'm trying to learn this piece on my watch.
Yes. It's also comforting to know, like, because it doesn't sound good, right? It was a hard talk to give because I was like, okay, I sound terrible right now, and I know this, and I'm doing this in public in front of like 200 of you, you know. But I think it's important for people to see that process in action. Like everybody goes through it. We don't wake up knowing things, and that's it's so much of engineering too, like. If all the problems were solvable, we wouldn't need engineers and it wouldn't be such a great career path. Engineers have a skill set, but they have to always solve a new, unique problem. They have to build something new to solve this problem. That's what makes it fascinating. Like, you know, so it's just like, and that learning, how do we learn constantly? I feel like that's a, it's the bias I have in hiring engineers. When I hire people for my team, I'm like, do you like to learn? And what is your frustration tolerance? How much can you tolerate being
Frustration
frustrated
tolerance. That's a very good
and get
point.
over it? Right? Because part of
Makes
learning
sense.
is being frustrated and then figuring out how to move through it. And people who don't, they're like, I can't do it. Like that fixed mindset, well, I can't do it, I'll never be able to do it, versus a growth mindset. How am I going to do this? I don't know how. How will I? What help do I need? What course, like, you know, I hire for that because that's more valuable to me. Skills are important. And from a mindset, that mindset will get somebody with less skill further than somebody who's extremely skilled, but also is like, no, I know what to do, and I refuse to learn anything else, or I don't want to talk to people or whatever. It's like, how much are you going to grow, right? Like, so yeah, learning theory informs so much of what I do in terms of team management and hiring.
Makes sense. Do you feel like Duolingo has done a fantastic job at like kind of systematizing it for the masses? Like exactly this theory. Today's human language? Or is it do you think it's something else?
I think it's a combination. The good news is that we can all find anything we want to find, basically. And if we can't find it, it's easy to make it. That's the world we live in, right? So, you know. So that's great. I think that a trouble that I see in education is that so many systems of education are so focused on skill acquisition and memorization. Like, oh, can you memorize these multiplication tables? These four, yeah. And it's like, it's a level of learning. There's a thing called Bloom's taxonomy, and it still applies, actually. It's from like the 60s, but it's basically like there's six levels of learning. The lowest is the lowest level of learning is like rote memorization. So, you know, your math facts, all that kind of stuff, right? But then the highest levels of learning are like synthesis and evaluation. So taking the facts, interacting with the world, not only just thinking about and analyzing them, but then going the next step and saying, okay, and what will I do? And then evaluation, how did that thing that I did work, right? So this exists, but most school systems focus on memorization through analysis, like the lower kind of levels. And it's really unfortunate because all the schools who are doing this testing, and I think that it's more international phenomenon, probably. I don't think it's just America. But the problem is that, okay, so you have all these students who know how to memorize stuff, but they don't know what to do with the stuff they've memorized.
Yeah.
Google has also memorized a lot of stuff.
Yeah. It can already do that for you. So what are you doing then?
Right. I mean, so, and I'm not saying knowledge is bad. I'm not saying skills are bad. I think they're necessary. And it's more necessary to figure out, okay, what can I do? How can I combine this information in a new way?
Yeah, to make something, or to create something.
Yeah. And if you look at ChatGPT, it still can't quite do it. Like it's fascinating in what it can do. And I have absolutely stumped it just asking questions that involve two different threads of my own interests. Because we're not to this place where it can take a sum of multiple kinds of knowledge and make something brand new, right? Like, could it happen? Probably. But this is, I'm fascinated by this, and I feel like schools need to teach for the thinking, and that's harder. It's so much harder. It's harder to evaluate. It's harder to have numbers to compare one school to another or country to another. And I'm like, why do we care? We need human beings that can think, right? So this is like deep, you know, like a peering into my deep mind about how frustrated I am.
Since I was in, for example, college, I was always very annoyed by the fact that the human knowledge as a whole is kind of divided by this very invisible walls called fields of study. Like, you know, you are in this field, you are in that field. And it kind of blinds people that, okay, if I am an engineer, that's who I am. And I cannot be a painter now. I cannot think like a painter. I cannot think like a violinist. Does it make sense? And we have these invisible walls that are kind of forced upon by the education system. Mm-hmm. And they are basically legally constructed after some point. Like,
yeah.
And also there's a psychological wall and a legal wall. So there are so many walls. And the point which I have never understood is that I did my computer science degree, but I was interested in dancing. So that's what I did when I was in college. I danced a lot.
Yeah.
And then I started this company, Sunday Pajamas, which was a design company, UI UX, branding, marketing. And now I'm doing podcasting. And when I'm talking to you, for example, I can talk about all those different things without any, I don't feel the wall, personally speaking. But when I talk to people, for example, they just hit this wall and they don't realize that they're not able to get out of it. And the problem is they never knew that they signed up for the wall. It was just kind of forced onto them.
Yes. Yeah. That's so astute.
So that's the context. Okay, that's the context. Now let's come to ChatGPT. Now, we are taking exactly this contextual knowledge of human knowledge, feeding it to an AI system, and guess what? It's learning the same stupid ideas that we should have solved by now, but now it's getting coded in an AI.
Yeah, it's the walls. It's, I mean, totally, right? I mean, it's a reflection of, AI is a reflection of us. Machine learning is a reflection. I mean, who makes it, right? Like, even any in a world 50 years or 100 years in the future where it could develop sentience,
yeah,
the root is still all of the systems that we have that inform all of the things that we do, right? And so the invisible walls, I mean, yeah, that's, I feel that deeply, because people that, you know, I have very rare conversations where people spend time talking to me about orchestra and teaching and engineering. And like, these are not the conversations I have often, you know, in orchestra world, everyone thinks I'm a music teacher, even, you know, they don't.
Yeah, that's all they think. Yep. Yep. I get it. I know what they're saying.
Yeah. And in engineering world, it's like, oh, yeah. And it's like so aggravating, because it's like, I'm a human being. I have multiple.
It does not matter what I do, you know?
Yeah. 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 It's like, yeah, I get that. It's frustrating, but I kind of am just like, okay, I don't care. Like, I'm going to do the things I enjoy and live my life, you know, and try to do my best to make the world, you know, the world a place that I want to be in, that I want my family to be in, and just use my skills that way. And
yeah,
you know, that's all the power I have, really.
I don't think I have shared this with a lot of people, because there was no context. There was never the context, but the main reason behind starting this thing we eventually called Sunday Pajamas is that we have a workshop business, and we have a fitness club that we use to organize running camps and cycling camps.
Oh, cool.
And we have the podcast, and we host cookouts where we, you know, just cook food and feed people.
That's awesome.
And the way we make money out of it is by consulting startups with their UI UX strategy. Now I'm learning to become a cloud engineer. I got AWS certified, learning Terraform.
Oh, nice.
So hopefully in the next couple of years, I'll be a hardcore cloud engineer, right? I'm learning the violin, and hopefully that has something to do with Sunday Pajamas in the, I don't know, right? I just started a newsletter, for example, because I enjoy writing, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you look at Sunday Pajamas, or what I like with the lens of the walls, it is very stupid business advice. You should not do it. Right. But if you ask me, this is so fulfilling. I love it. I love every day of my life. I do what I love doing. I go for runs, it helps the business. I play the violin, it helps the business. I cook food, it helps the business. Makes sense, right?
It makes perfect sense. I mean, I think it doesn't make sense for everybody.
It does not.
But there are certain people for whom it makes a lot of sense. And we are the type of people who we like having a little bit busy, like lots of different stimulations of different kinds. And for us, it does make sense. And that's, I think it's important to know it can look different for everybody too. Like, a business can look different, which is the thing that I've definitely struggled with, because the business advice I'm getting is like, oh, you need to do da da da. And I'm like, yeah, like, actually, I don't think I'm going to do it that way. I mean, I've spent a year and a half trying to do it the way that business consultants have said, and I'm not, you know, I realize that there's just some different factors that they aren't seeing. And so I'm pivoting. And that's okay too, right? Like, it's, and if, as long as I'm enjoying it and making an impact, eventually, like, yeah, that's so fascinating. Like, good. I mean, I'm very impressed with the AWS certification. That's awesome. I'm and you know, yeah, just ongoing learning is, to me, that's the spice of life. We have this whole beautiful world around us. Humans have made art and science and everything. And so being able to engage with all of the best parts of humanity, and that is like,
and I would say that's why I love technology, you know. If I did not, because it kind of enables people like me and you to actually do it. And
then to find each other.
And to find each other, exactly.
You know, like, I mean, without technology, I wouldn't know you were doing this. You wouldn't know I was doing my thing. Like, we wouldn't, and now we're connected. You know, we know each, I know that you have your, you know, Sunday Pajamas, and you're doing these great business things. You know that I'm, you know, doing the orchestra, and we both learned something different today. Like, something, we were coming away from this conversation each with new things to think about and experience. So that's tech. That's why I love it for the same reason.
A lot of things we both have been thinking, not exactly in the same words, but like the themes are kind of similar, I would say, like an overarching theme of our life. No? Yes.
Yeah.
It's so crazy, man. I have not been it able is. To meet. I have not met a single person, like maybe one. I know one friend of mine who is as crazy as we are, but I think you are just the second person, that nobody else.
Yeah, I have a similar. I mean, I know one other person, and then it's this. Yeah, it's very much. It's rare because it's quite intense, and a lot of people have difficulty with that. Like a lot of people are like, "You're too intense. I can't with you. Like you're too intense." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay. I mean, that's fine. It's just it makes me happy. So I'm not gonna not be happy."
Makes sense. Yeah, completely.
I'm just gonna live my life, and that's cool. But yeah, I agree. It's definitely it's not the usual. I mean, you find people who are very intense, but they're also really miserable. They're like, I have to be intense. And it's like, you're a miserable like person to be around. So good for you, I guess. Like, that's not the kind of, you know, I think we're both not talking about that. But just a real natural curiosity about many things. A combination of creative mind and analytical engineering mind and world curious mind, like all these things are, you know, ever growing inside of me. The more I know, the stupider I feel. So like the more I encounter, the more I feel like I don't know, which is great. What a good problem to have.
So when you talk to people, for example, someone new for the first time, and you kind of talk about all the different things you are involved in. I mean, I don't recommend doing that very often, but let's say you do that. What do you see them evaluating everything they know about themselves in front of you when you do that? Are they like kind of not okay about the whole situation, like kind of confused and curious and angry, maybe?
I think less angry, more confused and curious for sure. And then just picking the things where either they're really like, how did you get here? Or picking a thing that they relate to and then going deeper on that thing. Which is, I mean, that's probably the most common thing. Mostly there's a lot of confusion because there's like, how? And I'm like, what do you mean, how? Like, it's just, but you know, how are you doing all this? How are you keeping it all, like, whatever. Like, so the how thing comes up and then the confusion of like, what, how does these things relate to each other? Why would you do one or the other? Like, I think the invisible walls have a pretty big hold.
Yeah, it's, and you know, so I get a similar how a lot of times, and then you explain them because you are a kind person and they understand it during that time. But then I think the walls are so powerful. With, I think the next day, it's all gone. And then the same question again, but how? And it's like a lot of times, even if you try to explain it, it simply does not make sense. Like you're not able to go through it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's being understood is tough. It's tough because it's like, I mean, and I think all humans have that experience to a degree. And I think when your mind, I mean, I know that my mind works in a way that even I have a hard time understanding. So trying to explain all this is like, you know, I usually just choose a simple path because it's easier.
So what is a simple path? Like not share about it?
Or like if I'm at an engineering event, I'll talk about engineering. If I'm at a music event, like I'll talk about music. If I'm at a writing, like I have a writing group that I started with my partner, and if we're at writing group, I talk about writing, and I might reference something else, which might cause a question or two, but it's just, I almost have to simplify because otherwise the complexity is like a lot for, you know, it's just a lot. It's a lot to, for some people to like take on. And so I simplify by just, okay, here's the main topic. I might reference these other things if I'm feeling especially adventurous. Otherwise I'll just live in here and it'll be fine.
you know, the one experience I am having on the podcast is that no matter the guest, no matter who I'm talking to, we can go on. You know, the conversation can go on. And like, I don't know most of the things people are talking about. If there is a doctor who's talking about chronic health and he has spent like 10 years studying chronic health, he's a PhD on it. I might not know the whole thing, but I'll have one story or two references or one book I read or one random podcast I listened to 3 years ago. And then that's enough to kind of, you know, take the whole thing forward for 2-3 hours. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah. 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 And then you get more depth, right? Because you have that experience. I mean, in learning theory, this is scaffolding. Like you have we all have a scaffolding. And if we don't have it, we try to build it. So, but we take our experiences and then we connect and build on those experiences, just like the scaffolding on a building. And so it's a big part of learning theory, which many of us even do, we don't realize that we do it, but we do. And when we're unfamiliar with things and curious, we will create our own scaffolding. We'll go, we'll read, we'll research a little bit. We'll say, oh, I had this experience and that experience. That's like this. And you've had this. Tell me more. Help me make my scaffolding stronger.
Like how was the whole experience of that?
It felt great because you're asking things. You have good questions. Let's put it that way. Like you have good, deep questions that are interesting and things that I rarely get to talk about, which, so I like that I get to talk about them because it's just never something that most people don't care. They're just like, oh, that's really interesting that you play in an orchestra next. But there's actually a lot about it that's fascinating and you really dug into it. So I'm pretty, I feel good. I had a lot of fun.